Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we have a very special guest. He's an Edgar Award winner. Yes, he has won the Edgar Award. His name is David Ellis, and he has a new book called The Wrong Man, and it's just come out in hardcover from Putnam. Hello.
David, nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's a nice rainy night here in Pennsylvania. Rainy and cold, actually, but humid at the same time.
Well, it's sunny and warm in Chicago for once.
Will you send some of that nice weather over this?
Yeah, I'll try to blow it your way.
It would be nice. You got a blurb from James Patterson in the front of your book. How many people get that?
Well, not many, I guess, and I've been very lucky to, you know, the first book I ever wrote, we sent cold to James Patterson and some others, and he was really nice to give me a great blurb, and it started a kind of a relationship that we formed, and he's been such a supporter, and he's really kind of the, you know, he's the giant right now, and the great thing about him is he gives back so much. I mean, he's taken time to mentor me a little bit and give me advice and you know, the support with the blurbs and that kind of thing too. I mean, I know he doesn't say it if he doesn't mean it. He reads everything he blurbs, and if he doesn't like something, he won't blurb it.
Right, and you can't. How can you blurb something you don't like? I mean, hopefully nobody ever does that, but I mean, you can't really. I mean, if you don't like something, you don't like it. And, you know, this is such a good story, The Wrong Man. I really am enjoying this. I mean, I'm almost done. I'll probably be up all the rest of the night reading this. You realize it's one of those books you can't put down once you start reading it.
Well, I hope so. That's what we shoot for as authors, don't we?
Now, what's the Jason Cole? How is it pronounced? Is it Coleridge or Coleridge or
Coleridge? You know,
Coleridge.
He always tells people. You know, his name is repeatedly mispronounced by all the characters in his book, and he always gets annoyed, and he tells them that it's pronounced Cola like the drink and Rich like wealthy.
Right. Is that mentioned in one of the books?
I think he has said that from time to time, yeah.
I didn't read that yet.
Yeah, you know, I had a friend growing up whose last name was Coleridge, and I always thought he was a cool guy. And you know, when somebody is really cool, you sort of assign coolness to their name. So Coleridge was always a name I thought would be good. And you know, when I finally came up with a character that I was willing to draw a series around, I thought, you know, I could give him some real kind of, you know, superhero sort of name, and that didn't make sense to me, and I didn't want it to be too ordinary, and I thought Coleridge just sounded perfect.
It's interesting, the sun setting. I'm trying to figure out, as I'm reading the book, what the sunset has to do with anything, and why they put a sun. I always do that with books. I look at books and I think, oh, why would they have a cover like that? It's not a bad cover, but I just wonder why it's there. I mean, is it supposed to be wartime? I mean, is it supposed to reflect on, like, wartime?
No, not so much. I don't know. We went back and forth on this a lot, and the first time I saw the cover, I actually said I didn't like it. I said it's too peaceful. It looks like dawn and very serene. But then, you know, when you look at it a little bit more, it's got a little bit of darkness to it. It's got kind of an eerie atmosphere to it. I don't like cliches on, you know, for covers, especially when you're a guy who writes legal thrillers. They always want to put, you know, scales of justice or courtroom pillars, and I always thought, let's not do that anymore. Let's do something unique. And I thought this was unique. It actually fits a couple of the scenes in the book where there's some things happening at sunrise. And I think overall, you know, I hope it has some kind of an eerie sense to it. That's what I was.
Do you feel the same way though? When you look at a book, do you wonder why the cover is like it is?
Well, I certainly initially will sometimes judge a book by its cover, which of course we're told not to do because it matters. And it's funny, you know, when you get into the marketing side of this business, the cover is a huge part of it. Yeah, I think that the cover and the title will both convey an impression about the book. It's just like a movie. I'll sometimes decide what movie to pick based on, you know, a little description of it or the title. It's the same thing. It's the marketing of it, and it's the first impression a reader gets is here's the title and here's the cover. And if it doesn't hit you, you know, if you could write the greatest book since To Kill a Mockingbird, but if you've got a goofy title to it and a funny looking cover, people probably won't buy it.
How hard? I mean, this The Wrong Man is such an interesting book. I mean, I wonder as I'm reading it, I think, how did he do this? There's so many little details in this book, and I mean, when you're writing the book, do you figure out all those details beforehand, or you couldn't do it as you went along? I don't think it would work, would it?
Well, you know, that's the great thing about this modern era writing with computers. You know, you can write out of order, you can change things, you can add things later. So some of it I did plan in advance, and some of it I researched in advance because I knew what I was going to have to know certain things about, you know.
Well, where does the story come from? I mean, does the story always come to you in a whole way? I mean, do you see the whole story in your mind, or do you just see parts of it in the beginning?
Usually for me, David, I see parts of it at the beginning. I see a concept, I see a beginning and an end, and then I got to fill in those middle 400 pages that sort of also matter. So I start with that. So I started here with, we've got a guy who is accused of a murder who is mentally ill, and it looks like a straight insanity case. It's an Iraqi war veteran who suffers from post-traumatic stress, so you're going to plead insanity and fight the case like John Hinckley fought it when he was charged with shooting President Reagan. Pretty straightforward case. And then suddenly you realize, as you're preparing for trial, maybe insanity is the wrong thing. Maybe the guy is innocent. And then he starts digging in, and what's he going to come up with? So, you know, the story sort of began with that sort of a concept. You think you've got a straight insanity case. You realize, oh, wait a second, not only is insanity the wrong defense, this guy's innocent. So now I have to, you know, on the eve of trial, I have to rejigger my entire defense. And then he's going to have to, you know, figure out who really did it. And then you start thinking, well, what's going to be the real story? And so then my next step was, well, maybe the victim was onto something. She was uncovering something. And so then I got to think to myself, what was she uncovering? And that's when I got into the full-scale plot of the book.
That's neat. It's neat to hear how the writer is thinking up the story. I mean, how all those things that go through your mind. What if? I mean, writer. I've always heard writers saying, "What if? What if this? What if?" And then the suddenly the situation comes to them. Oh yeah, that's a good idea for a book. Let's make a book out of that.
Yeah, and then you sometimes you know, what's really unsettling is when you start a book not sure that you know everything, and then you have to sort of figure it out as you go along. And there are writers who do that. There are writers who take sort of a kamikaze approach and just start writing and figuring that they have the confidence in themselves to come up with something cool later. I tend to, especially as I've gone on in writing, I try to structure as much of it as I can ahead of time. Not a chapter-by-chapter outline, but a basic structure of what the book's going to be about. Some people don't, and some people, you know, James Patterson, to name one, he likes to outline virtually every chapter before he starts.
Well, you're,
everybody's got their own approach.
Yeah, you're a lawyer during the day, and do you write these books at night, or do you wake up early in the morning and write them?
I usually write them at night. I write them after everyone's gone to bed, except for me.
Well, aren't you exhausted by then?
Yeah, I am, which is why it's a good thing that I love doing it so much. With something boring, I wouldn't be able to stay awake. And even doing something I love, I often will fall asleep at my computer at 2 in the morning. It's been known to happen. My wife can tell you.
Right.
I've got three little kids. I've got a 9-month-old child, and I've got a 2- and a 5-year-old. So,
oh, wow. You're busy.
So, yeah, so there's no time until everyone's asleep, and then you hope they don't get up.
I guess as the kids get older, it's going to be harder to write because they're going to demand more of your attention, I would think.
For a while they will, and then they'll demand less probably.
Yeah, exactly.
And they'll break my heart, and they'll stop loving me as much, and they'll start doing other things and forget how great their daddy is.
Do you think you'll be writing till the day you die?
Yes, I do. That's my plan. I mean, I don't, you know,
I've never asked an author that question before. It just suddenly hit me. That's a good question to ask.
I can't imagine stopping. I like it too much. It's too much of what I've become. I wouldn't know what to do with myself, David. I mean, if the day came when every publisher said, we no longer want you, you know, in this era with self-publishing, I suppose if it ever came to that, and it doesn't look like it's going to come to that, I'm happy to say I've been, you know, had a lot of success with my publisher, but if it ever did come to that, I would probably just continue doing it in a self-publishing way. I can't imagine stopping. It's just, I might write less often, I might produce less, but stopping completely seems like I don't know how authors do it. I don't know how they stop. It's sort of an infectious disease inside of you. You got to keep getting it out.
What's also interesting about this book is right in the middle of the book, I'm thinking, I don't think Jason's going to survive this book. There's just no way he can survive this book. It's kind of freaky reading this. And I mean, I don't know how it ends yet because I haven't finished it yet. I think that's better when I do the interview. I haven't finished the book because I'm liable to give something away.
Sure.
Liable to give something away I shouldn't. But I mean, And I think that makes the book better, that sense of danger that runs through this book.
You know, it's a tricky thing, because I used to not write a series. My first 5 books were standalones. And so I always knew that if I needed to, I could kill the narrator. I could kill the protagonist. I could kill anybody. And when you have standalones, that's always a threat. When you have a series, it becomes trickier, because most people who are intelligent, and most people who read books are intelligent, will think to themselves on some level, well, this guy's not going to die. He can't die. And so the trick is, if you've got a character who pretty much is going to survive, is, you know, can you add other drama to it? Can you hurt him in other ways than killing him? Can you take away a loved one? Can you ruin his job? Can you ruin his life somehow? Can you ruin his reputation? But also, you know, in a thriller, you are going to put them in mortal danger. And so the key will be, how can I make that traumatic? And I struggle with that all the time. I had a scene in my last book, Breach of Trust, where Jason was basically being interrogated by people. And I put him into a situation that even I, when I wrote it, said, I can't get him out of this. I don't know how to get him out of it.
Yeah.
But of course I was going to get him out of it. And it was interesting, the Chicago Tribune wrote a review of the book, and they started by talking about that scene. They went right to that scene in the review, and they said, as an intelligent reader, I know he's going to survive, but I had no idea how. And so, you know, what was fun for that reviewer, and I hope for every reader, is even though you know he's going to make it, it's the fun of figuring out how.
No, I didn't see, are the reviews good on The Wrong Man so far?
They've been great so far. I got a starred review from Booklist, and Kirkus gave a nice review. And
Kirkus is like, they're like the hardest people to impress ever. Them and Library Journal.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so I was very happy. And but it hasn't come out yet. You know, the book really hasn't even come out yet. So the reviews are just going to start coming in now.
Right.
It's coming out on Thursday. But that's the challenge. You know, Lee Child is an author that we all read, and Jack Reacher's not going to die. But you know, we still keep turning the pages to see how he's going to get through these things.
And at the same time, the trick of the author is to make it seem like he's going to die somehow. The possibility is there that he won't, that Jack Reacher won't survive. You did that with, I think, the last book. Before the last book, he sort of left him stuck in a mine somewhere.
Yeah, he had an explosion and then he ended the book.
Right.
And I didn't really think he was dead, but it was, you know, it did make you think until the next book came out, it made you wonder a little bit. But that really, you know, you've identified the big conflict for someone who's writing a series is how do you make his danger interesting even though the reader knows he's in the back of their mind, he's not going to die. And I think that the fun is in thinking about how is this person going to survive? How are they going to pull this off? And so I put Jason in The Wrong Man into some serious jeopardy. And I think that how he gets out of it is part of the fun. I think that's what readers know. They're buying into that.
And I like the fact that Jason, when he's preparing the case, you know, things are happening. And at one point I'm thinking, I don't even know that he has a case. I'm not sure the man has a case. And what's going to happen if he doesn't have a case? And that's what you're a thinking man's thriller writer, I think. You make people think when they're reading the book, you know, what. Where is he going to go with this? How's the story going to progress? Because this could lead to a dead end. It's like going through a maze. You hit this dead end. What do I do now? Where do I go?
And the other thing I try to do is I try to make him human. I mean, he sometimes gets a little arrogant. At one point, he takes a pretty big risk in his case, thinking that he'll get the judge to do something, but you never know how a judge is going to rule. And the judge goes against him, and he finds himself in a very bad spot. And he's sitting here thinking to himself, I'm having the worst fear that a defense attorney can have, which is not that I'm going to lose a case, but that an innocent man will go to prison because I screwed up. I mean, that's what sends fear into the hearts of a defense attorney. Defense attorneys represent guilty people all the time, and they do their best to win. But at the end of the day, when those people go to prison, which most of the time they do when they're charged with crimes, a defense attorney can sleep at night knowing, okay, the guy was guilty. I did my best. But he was guilty. It's the innocent ones that keep people up at night.
Right.
And Jason believes this guy to be innocent and believes he may have just screwed up the case. In his zealousness and his arrogance, thinking that he could figure out a way out of it, he put his client into a box. And that's his greatest fear.
And what strikes me as different about Jason is that he's not really he doesn't seem to be a worrier. He's more of a thought. He's more into the thought processes. I mean, we see what's going through his mind and how things are going to play out. It's like a chess game to him. He can see if this happens, then this is going to happen, then this is going to happen. And he's seeing far ahead into the future about what's going to happen if he does one thing wrong or if he does it right, how it could turn out right.
Yeah, you know, I think he thinks of himself as a warrior in battle. And you know, when you're in battle, when you're really in the heat of things, you don't have time to say, boy, I really made a mistake there. You say, okay, I am where I am, now what? Yeah. And so
what's
he screws up and he gets mad at himself, but then he says, okay, what's my next move?
Are you like that too?
You have to be, David. I mean, if you're going to be a good lawyer, you have to take the setbacks in stride. I mean, you have to say, okay, messed that one up, or something went the wrong way because maybe I didn't argue it well enough. Okay, now what? Let's fix it. You have to, because if you just sit there and dwell on it, then you've lost the case. You got to keep fighting until you win.
And that's why lawyers do so well in Jeopardy, because they're so smart to begin with.
I don't know. We you know, it's a lot of hard work, and you know, you try to do your best, but you really do have to have that mentality. I think the people who really want to win the most, the real fierce competitors. I think if you're a good competitor, you don't dwell on your mistakes. You try to learn from them, but then you move on.
But do you ever have a? How long have you been a lawyer?
19 years.
19 years. Have you ever felt that your life was endangered?
No.
Never in 19 years. Now, obviously, for the book, you know, it's got you want that sense of danger for the character. But I just wondered, as a lawyer, whether you ever felt that way.
When I was in Springfield, when I was at the state capital of Illinois, and I was, you probably know, I prosecuted Rod Blagojevich when he was governor.
Right.
I was the House prosecutor. I was sometimes a little bit worried about holding that kind of a position, because it was a very high profile position. I mean, people around the country and frankly around the world were watching this trial, and I was getting media requests from all over the place, and I was getting all kinds of crazy phone calls from people, and some people weren't happy that we were prosecuting the governor. They thought he was innocent, he was, you know, being wrongly, you know, pursued, whatever you want to say. I'd get some crazy calls. I got some emails that were sort of strange, and so, you know, at that point I thought, well, this is a little creepy, and I had a young child at home and a pregnant mm-hmm. wife, and you know, you get very protective about that.
Absolutely, I would think.
Yeah, so there were times where I felt maybe a little uneasy. I would not ever say that I felt like my life was in danger. It was nothing of that level, but yeah, you know, you get it kind of a crank email, and you read it, and you say, well, wait a second, you know. And it occurred to me from time to time that I might want to ask the state police to protect me. But it never got, I don't want to overstate this, it never got to any kind of extreme level, just a few goofy phone
right.
calls.
I just wonder if, I mean, I'm trying to think of, I guess that happened to Perry Mason at some time during his show.
Well, sure, I mean, you know, Jason is defending criminals, people convicted of
right.
crimes and or accused of crimes and often who are themselves criminals, and I'm not a criminal defense attorney, I never really have been.
Right.
So I've never really, you know, if you start representing people in the mafia or gangs, I mean, you got to start worrying about things like that, sure.
Absolutely. Now, I have to ask you about Chapter 61. Now, if anybody out there hasn't read the book yet, I mean, you're in for a treat with Chapter 61. I assume you know what went on in that chapter.
I do now, because I just turned to it.
But, I mean, I'm laughing. The whole chapter is so surreal. I mean, when I first read it, I read it this morning. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, this is the most unusual chapter I've ever seen in the book.
It was something I thought long and hard about, because here in the middle of some high tension, some people who really want to do some bad things to my character, I introduced some humor. And so I thought, well,
and it works.
Okay.
It's very effective.
But it was a real risk, because It almost turns a very dangerous situation into something that's humorous. But I thought, let me try it. It came to me. I'm not sure how it came to me. It wasn't planned. And then I thought, you know, what would happen? I mean, you said before, David, you know, you asked the question, what if? So what if you were, you know, planning to, you know, attack somebody and this happened to you? And you probably wouldn't know what to do. And so he sort of turns the tables on people, and I think the way they react is the way people would react in that situation. I mean, I've never seen a situation like this, and you and I are, you know, being very vague about it, of course, not telling anybody
right.
exactly what happens. But yeah, I wrote it, and I was fully expecting my publisher to say, "You can't do this. This is high drama, high tension, you know, life and death moment, and you introduce something funny." And hopefully more than funny, but quite funny.
I'd like
they
to
didn't.
See.
They said they liked it.
I'd love to see that police car. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
I kept reading that. I thought, oh my gosh, I mean, this is just, I mean, what's going on in this chapter? And then when you suddenly realize what really is going on, it's so clever the way it's done. I mean, it's like, you watch it unfold, and you're like, well, wait a minute. What is it? I mean, you're getting hit with all this stuff, and then you suddenly realize, oh, I get it.
Literally, right? Literally getting hit with stuff.
Right.
You know something I can tell you, David? I was laughing while I was writing it, and that was a good sign for me. I was literally laughing out loud, and I almost never do that. I was cracking myself up while I was writing it. And so that told me that there was, you know, because, you know, when you're writing these books, you're trying to keep people invested in some way. You know, and this is something Patterson always says to me, you know, you should have an exclamation point in every chapter. Not literally, but you should have some punch to each chapter, whether it's funny, scary, sad, heartbreaking, steamy, whatever it is. And I thought, why not? Why not have this be hilarious? You know, I mean, you know, I don't care if someone's reading my book and they're laughing out loud. That's a great reaction. That means I'm really reaching you.
Well, I'm laughing thinking about the chapter. Now everybody's going to rush out to read chapter 61.
Well, I hope so.
But can't read it without reading the rest of the book. I mean, literally, you do not read chapter 61 if you haven't read the first 60 chapters.
I'm kind of laughing thinking about it, too. I was laughing out loud while I was writing it, and I literally almost never do that. I almost have cried while writing chapters, but I've never laughed out loud before.
Isn't it boring writing briefs?
No, but it's different. I mean, it's just completely different than writing.
I mean, nobody ever captures that in a book, I think, because I'm thinking of all the legal thrillers I've ever read, and nothing ever gets said about. I mean, they sit and they write, and they never make it seem like it's very hard, but it's got to be a very hard process of writing a brief, and boring at times, or isn't it?
Not you know, it's no more boring than researching a work of fiction, because you've got an end in mind. But really, the same basic principles apply. It's never about how many syllables are in your words or how fancy you can say something. It's about connecting. It's really the same principle. I want to connect with the reader. If I could summarize in one sentence what writing is to me, good writing, it's connecting with whoever's reading it. If it's a brief, I want to connect with the judge. I want them to say, oh, I get what he's saying, and he's right. He's totally right about this. And he's now explaining why the other side is wrong, and he's totally right about that. The other side is full of you-know-what, and this guy is right. He's explained it to me clearly, and he's not trying to hide anything. He's coming straight out, and he's getting to what I want to know. He's answering my questions. He's anticipating and answering my questions. That's how I connect with a judge. I connect with a reader differently, but I'm still doing the same thing. I'm thinking about the reader, and how can I grab them? How can I trick them if I'm a suspense writer and a mystery writer, which I am? How can I fool them? How can I make them care about my characters? How can I scare them? How can I make them laugh? Whatever my goal is in that particular chapter, it's about that connection. That's why I say, if I see someone reading my book and they're laughing, or they're crying, or they're getting angry, that's a very fulfilling feeling. When I win a case because a court relied on my brief and ruled in my favor, that means I connected with them.
I would think the worst thing was if somebody came up to you and said, it was okay. If they were talking about one of your books.
And the thing is
you never want your book to be okay. I mean, I want to feel like when I'm done this book, I don't know what I'm going to read next because I enjoyed it so much.
Yeah, I obviously that's what I'm shooting for too. I try not to be boring and ordinary. I try to take chances, and I won't win everybody's praise for that. I mean, there's no way if tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people are reading your book that they're all going to like it. I wrote a book in reverse chronological order a few years ago, In the Company of Liars.
Oh, I read that, yes.
Yeah, and some people wrote to me and said, don't ever write a book backwards again. I couldn't follow it. It is hard to follow.
Right.
It went chapter by chapter backwards, so every day, the next chapter was the day before. And so you're going backwards in time.
I think Daniel Judson did that too, didn't he?
I don't know of anybody else who's done it.
I think he did it, and he did it really well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real trick. It's hard, but it can be done. And I tried to do it right, and most people said, wow, this is something new. You know, in the thriller genre, when it's hard to find something new, you started at the end and went backwards to the beginning and gave us a surprising beginning, a beginning we didn't see coming. I mean, you know, it's crazy. And so some people said, thank you for taking a chance and giving us something we've never seen before. And other people said, I like your other books. I'm on the beach right now. I don't want to think this hard.
Right.
Okay, I respect that. I mean, every reader is right.
Oh,
no reader is wrong. It's whatever you think, and you try to, you know, you want to please as many people as you can, but you also want to write your best book. And you can. There's no perfect equilibrium there.
Well, look at P.D. Jane. She's writing these mysteries, and all of a sudden she writes a futuristic book that's extremely depressing, and nobody liked it. I mean, I say nobody liked it, but I think at first it was a shock. Everybody's like, that's not the P.D. James I remember. That's not the author I remember. So, I mean, the readers expect a certain thing from the authors they like, I guess. And I mean, I know I do, but I don't mind if they do something different as long as it works and as long as it's just as interesting as the other books.
Yeah, and that's always the challenge, and there's stories on both sides of that. You know, Dennis Lehane was writing a series that people basically liked, Patrick and Angie, and you know, I liked his books. I liked them quite a bit, in fact, and he had a winner there. And then he said, you know what, screw it. I'm going to write a book called Mystic River, and I'm going to have all new characters, and it's going to be depressing as hell. And it launched him. I mean, he was already doing pretty
right.
well, but it put him into a stratosphere all his own. And, you know.
And it's an unforgettable book. If you haven't read it, you need to read Mystic River.
No, it's a phenomenal. It's one of my favorite books of all time. And I met him once, and I told him that, and he couldn't have been nicer. He's one of the nicest, most down-to-earth people you could ever meet. The guy would sit next to you on a train and talk your ear off and listen to your problems, and he's just, Dennis is just a terrific guy.
So how do you do it? I mean, you wake up early, you're a lawyer during the day, you come home, your kids are there, you're writing at night, and you're saying you're staying up till 2 in some mornings, some evenings, but how do you do that? How do you do that? You don't have much time for yourself.
Well, this is my time for myself. I mean, this is what I do for myself. I used to be a marathon runner, and
so actually, writing is the time for yourself.
Oh, sure, it's what I look forward to. It's my passion.
So it's never work. You never come home and you say, "Oh, I just don't feel like writing tonight."
You know, I mean, occasionally I do, but it's very rare, and sometimes it feels like work, and those are some of my most depressing days when it's not fun. I'll give you an example. I'm plotting out my next book, and when I'm plotting a book, I could spend hours thinking, well, maybe I'll do this, and let me research that a little bit. No, I'm not going to do that. How about I try this? And a day could end, and I haven't written a word because I'm just thinking. And I'm a guy who likes to check boxes. I wrote 2 chapters today, or I thought of this idea today. And if I'm just trying to come up with an idea, I could sit there and pace the room for hours and have nothing to show for it, and I hate that. Like, I had that a couple days ago, and it was one of my worst days that I can remember because, at least as a writer, I mean, the rest of my life is fine, but as a writer, that was a really bad day for me because it was just a chore. I was banging my head against the wall and not coming up with any good ideas. But when I'm writing, I love writing. I mean, there's just, you know, if you're stuck on something, go back to an earlier chapter and make that chapter better. There's always something you can do.
But that's,
you can always reread something.
So it isn't really work to you, then?
No. Writing is not work.
I mean, I have authors that will tell me writing is work. It's a lot of work, but it all.
Well, it depends on how you use the word. Obviously, it's a huge amount of effort, but it's so rewarding to me, especially when you write those chapters. Everyone's got a few chapters that they just think, "Wow, I nailed it."
Chapter 61.
Well, I really like chapter 61. I tend to like very dramatic and moving parts. I like the ends of the ends of my books are very important to me, not just because of the surprise, but because I'm always very emotional at the end of my books. Personally, I'm emotional because I'm saying goodbye to a story and I'm saying goodbye to not.
Really? You felt that way with every book?
I think every book, yeah.
Are you an emotional person to begin with?
No, but. Not particularly. I'm not a crier or anything like that.
We wouldn't
more
blame you if you
had
were.
Children. Yeah, no, I understand. I've become more emotional since I've had kids. You know, things just matter to me more. You know, you just realize the great things in life. You know, the things that move me are not so much the bad things, but the really good things. And most of my books end bittersweet. There's some bad things that happen. Usually a character's been pretty badly damaged, but they've usually managed to prevail in some form or another. And, that's emotional, and I always, you know, I don't let go of an ending of a book unless I think, wow, I really got it. I really nailed it, you know, and that's a great feeling. You know, those chapters that you write where you just got it exactly right, that's what you live for as a writer. That's the best feeling.
In fact, I'm going to market your book when I'm selling it at the store. I'm going to tell people about chapter 61. That's going to hook a lot of people. I can't wait to do that now because it's just now everybody's and they're all going to wonder. You know, now I have to buy it because I have to read chapter 61.
Well, I did love it. I mean, now they're going to be building up to chapter 61 and saying, okay, here it comes. You know, so that you know we'll see how
it's fine.
It lives up to the billing.
I think that, I mean, when you look at the, you know, the way they market things. There are certain things that you can market about everything, and if you do it the right way, you know, I mean, look how many people were curious about to the Twilight series. Now they've sold multi-million copies of the book, and you know, and I think the bottom line is it's a love story, and that's what people love. They love love stories.
Yeah, it's amazing, and what's going to hit next, and. You know, something like Fifty Shades of Grey, which I don't know very much about, but I think I get the general idea of what's appealing about it. It's just very erotic, and who knew? I mean, who knew that was going to take off? Nobody knows these things.
But the thing is he being mean to her? Is he treating her badly? Or does she really want it? Or I mean, there's so many complexities to the book. I mean, it's like, is it just brutality to women? Is that all it's about? Or is there more to it than that?
Yeah, you know, right. But who knew that was going to be a huge hit? I mean, somebody must have said, "Well, let's go crazy with this book and market it and do all this stuff to make it this big hit." Because it doesn't become a hit without something behind it.
No.
Somebody had to see something in it, and everyone's trying to be that next person. I try not to do that. I mean, people for a while, for example, my publisher would say, "Well, the legal thriller." Per se, like the courtroom thriller, not as big as it used to be. You know, there was a while, especially with Turow, he wrote Presumed Innocent and some of that. They wanted the Perry Mason moments. They wanted the courtroom trial with the Perry Mason moment. And my first few books, that's all I did. I mean, it wasn't all I did, but hopefully they were very exciting thrillers, but ultimately the climax came in a courtroom. And then they said, well, maybe that's not as big anymore. So I said, well, okay, I'm willing to move off that a little bit, but, you know, I'm not going to write the next, you know, Tom Clancy book. That's just not what I do. I write psychological thrillers with some violence in it, of course.
And always a shock at the end?
Always. I mean, that's what I go for. I always try to have some...
You go for the jugular. Is that what they mean by going for the jugular?
Well, that's what I try to do. I try to have a head-spinning surprise at the end. It's a very tough thing to hold yourself up to. I can only think of one book where I didn't do that. And that was my last book, Breach of Trust, which was a whole different kind of book because it was based on loosely on the Blagojevich scandal and a undercover FBI investigation. And so that was a different book.
Now, I have to mention the relationship between Jason and his sidekick. What's his name now? I'm forgetting his name. The one that tells it like it is.
Yeah, Joel Leitner, his detective, yeah.
I mean, I think their relationship is something special. I think that's something you should play with. I mean, this is just my theory, but I think those scenes between them really work really well because Joel doesn't hold back at all.
No, he's got no filter, and that's what we like about Joel. It's interesting, David, because I'm not used to having a series. This is only my third book in the series, and I've always had loners. And I like loners. I like writing loners. I never wanted to give them families because I thought that's happy and that's boring. Happy is boring. So I always wanted them to be alone and somewhat dark, and most of my characters were. And Jason is plenty dark, no question. He's a kind of a bull in a china shop sort of guy, and he's damaged. But he does have these people around him. He's got a law partner, Shauna, who's his best friend. He's got Joel Leitner, who's his private detective, who's great fun to be around, very entertaining guy, and so, you know, how do I develop that? And, that, you know, when I'm writing loner characters, I now have these people around him who can't just stay the same in every book. I've got to develop something there, and I'm never entirely sure how I'm going to do that.
And I want to know if Tori really looks like Tori Spelling.
Well,
I don't know why, because that name just, of course, Tori, there's only, and it's spelled the way it is. I immediately think of Tori Spelling.
I hadn't even thought of that until you said it, but now she's going to be in my head. She's blonde and petite and attractive.
Right.
Story spelling to you, then yeah, maybe so.
But I mean, that's what is also going to appeal to people, the love story between him and Tori. Now, I don't know how it ends up because I haven't finished the book yet. So for all I know, they break up at the end. I don't even know. So I can say that, but I like that that's developing. And she's a tough cookie.
Yeah, and he's drawn to that. He likes people who have their walls up. You know, she's got walls up. She's had a tough life.
But the way you write your books, I mean, do you draw from real-time experiences? Did you date somebody like that and have a relationship build like that? I mean, did that happen to you? Is that the way you draw, or do you just take it right from fiction?
No, that I did not draw anything from my personal life. That's just nothing like anything I'm used to.
But there must be something that you have in some of your books. Not that I want you to tell me what it is. But.
Oh, that's probably true. I mean, there's no way that a book isn't going to sound a little bit like you. if you're writing contemporary fiction, I mean, if you're writing, you know, people in Narnia or, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien or something, maybe not. But at any time in real time and contemporary with real people, it's going to sound like you. And people who know me will say, yeah, Jason sounds like you. You know, some of my other characters, yeah, that's your sense of humor, you know.
Is he the same age as you?
Jason is a little bit younger.
He's younger, okay.
He's in his 30s. I don't think I've ever defined him too much. You know, that's another thing about writing a series is once you put a fact in about that person, it stays.
Right.
So I'm now finding myself having to keep track of things that I've said about him in other books. I have an assistant who I've asked to chronicle everything I've ever said about Jason, anything I've pinned down about him, like the name of his high school, you know, or some girl he dated or the street he lived on, so that I, you know, when I go back to that ever in the future, I can make sure that a reader can't say, hey, you screwed up. I'm not used to that. I'm pinning myself down a little bit, and I'm not used to being pinned down.
Right. And, you know, and I think it's, and we know that Jason's vulnerable. I mean, I'm not seeing a lot of it in this book. I mean, I see the insecurities in his head, but is he a vulnerable character? Are you going to make things happen to him in later books?
I think he is, and what I think is starting to show more and more with Jason is his heart. He's a very tough guy, and he's gone through a tremendous tragedy. And if you've read the first two books, you know what I mean, and it won't be a secret in this book. It'll be revealed, I think, pretty much at the outset. But he's suffered a terrible tragedy, so he's without a family now. And it tore him to shreds. In fact, that is probably why I picked him to be a series character, because I didn't go into it thinking I'm going to write a series, even though my publisher has always wanted me to. I went in just thinking I'm writing another book. But the great thing about him is, contrasted with my other protagonists went through the ringer in every book. I tore them apart, and by the end of the book, there was so little left of them that I really couldn't write another story about them. Jason has already been torn apart. He's already suffered about the worst thing that he could suffer in his life. And so he is rebuilding, and he's a lot tougher. He has a much thicker shell around him. He doesn't, you know, part of him, I think, wants to find love again and wants to, you know, do all the things that grown-ups do. But he's not sure if he wants to or not.
But let's face it, what makes a character work a lot of times is their vulnerabilities. Is them suddenly doing something so horrifying. Can you ever bring them back from that? I mean, when Michael Connelly writes about Harry Bosch, I mean, Harry Bosch does some underhanded things.
Uh-huh.
And the last book I read of his, it made me angry. I thought, well, that's not Harry Bosch, and Harry would never do something like that. But, you know, and then I wonder, you know, how far do you take a character?
Well, that's the ultimate question. You know, I've often asked myself, will Jason ever kill somebody? And my wife said to me, Jason can't kill anybody. He's a tough guy. He'll beat people up. He'll break rules to do the right thing, but he won't kill anybody. Well, maybe he will. I don't know. I'm going to have to see where the books take me.
Well, if somebody threatened Tori, he would kill them.
Yeah. I mean, I can't wait for you to read the rest of the book, David. And then tell me what you think about their relationship. It'll take an
Oh, there's more coming. I didn't realize
that. Well,
I always step on a landmine when I say things like that when I haven't finished the book.
Not at all. We should talk again after you've finished reading it. Jason is vulnerable, and I totally agree with you. To just have a tough guy who has no vulnerability, who just has no heart, he's just a tough guy who kicks ass, that's not interesting to me. Jason just takes a little longer to reveal it, and he doesn't really admit it to himself. But deep down, he's a lawyer who wants to get the fair result. Now, there are rules that get in the way sometimes, and he might break those rules, but he's got his own code, and he stays true to his code, regardless of whether he violates ethics rules, and he does. In every book, I think, that I've done, he's broken some rule of a lawyer's ethics.
And it's interesting with books about lawyers. They can be, I mean, the fiction ones anyway, they can be very boring. You can't have, I mean, to me, I don't want to read about a lawyer who's just like every other lawyer I've read about. There has to be something different. William Lasher did a great job with his lawyer because he was a poor lawyer, basically. He really didn't have much money, but he was so... He would just always have these humorous situations happen to him. It just made him something special. And that's what I want to read when I read law thrillers. I want something special.
You want something unique, and you know.
I don't want him to be a womanizer. I don't want him to be you know, chasing skirts like they do. I mean, and that's what I ask myself when I'm reading this book, is he just after Tori for the sex, or does he really love this woman, and does he know? He obviously knows what love is because he's been in love, but can he ever love again, you know?
And he's wondering that, and so he's kind of off on an island right now, and he's trying to find his way back.
Well, your book is so thought-provoking. I think we've got a lot of people interested in wanting to read. I mean, you're really going to have a good time reading it. And it's a fast-paced book, too, which is interesting, because you can't wait to see what happens in the next chapter. And your chapters are rather short, but it works. It's very effective for the storytelling.
Well, I think, you know, it's... I know that, you know, when I wrote the book with James Patterson, you know, he's obviously a big fan of short chapters, and there's a very obvious reason. It's pacing, and it's forcing you to pack everything in as tightly as possible, not boring, you know, just text that people don't really want to read while they're trying to get to the next piece of action, but packing it all in, condensing it. And I don't write exactly like that, and I don't hold myself to a specific number of words or anything like that.
Well, did you ever come up with an idea when you were writing with him and he said, no, you can't do that? Did that ever happen?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There were ideas that you had that he didn't like.
Yeah, sure.
And but that happens when you write with another person. I mean, you're going to have times when you're going to disagree.
Yeah, and I trust him because he's managed to find the pulse of readers so well that he's probably right and I'm probably wrong most of the time. But there have been times where I have said, well, let's go this direction. And he said, I'm not so sure. But then he said, you know what, try it, and if it works, great. I mean, that's the thing about him. He's not rigid at all. His whole working philosophy is, will it work? If it works, if it's dramatic and exciting and different, then great, do it.
Now, are you able to do that with your own work? I mean, when you were writing The Wrong Man, did you know when a chapter wasn't working? Did you suddenly get to the end of a chapter and think, I don't like this chapter, I'm going to write it again?
Oh, sure, it happens all the time.
Didn't happen with chapter 61, I can tell you that.
No, chapter 61 was, I did think about that a lot. I wondered, I was very unsure that it would be something.
Well, why though? I wonder why. I think it's a masterpiece. I love it.
Well, I did too, obviously, which is why I left it in. And it was so different and such a disarming sort of change up that I thought, hey, great, keep the reader on their toes a little bit. And it also advanced the plot. It did some things that will, you know, make sense later. It helps everything happen.
Oh, really?
At the end, sure, sure.
You realize I'm going to be up all night reading the rest of this book now. And so is everybody out there listening.
Oh, you know? Well, I hope so. I hope so. You have to have the ability. You know, writing well is a skill, sure, and you hone that as you do it more. Just like you build a muscle, the more you lift weights. But another equally important skill is the ability to be objective about your own work. That's right. How I wrote my first book. It's not that I knew how to write a book, because I didn't. I just kept writing it until it was good. I just kept changing it. I kept saying, this is...
But how do you know that? I mean, how do you know when a book is as good as you can get it?
Well, I'm not sure I have the answer to that. I mean, that's one skill I brought in, was I had the ability to distinguish good writing from bad. Even if I couldn't write well myself yet, I could figure out, this is not good enough, it needs to be better. And I just kept rewriting it and rewriting it, and I said, now that's good.
Right. Have you ever read a book that everybody in the world was saying was a great book and didn't like?
You know, I can't think of one, but I know that that has happened, sure. I know it's happened with movies.
I think of a book called The Bridges of Madison County, which was huge back in its day.
Sure.
And I think he wrote that in like 10 days or some ridiculously small period of time. But you know what? I read that book. It affected me in ways that I can't even describe. And it worked for me completely. But it didn't work for a lot of people. I mean, it did sell tremendously well, but there are people that I work with at the store that would tell me, oh, that was drivel. That was terrible.
Yeah, no, that absolutely happens. It's just like, you know, some people like onions and some people hate them. I mean,
But that book worked for me. It affected me. I mean, I really believed the love story. And I think that's why it worked for me. I think, and is it the best writing I've ever read? Of course not. But did I enjoy the book? And this goes to the 50 Shades of Grey series, too. Did I read all three books? Yes. Did I enjoy them? Oh, yes. But, you know, are they the best writing I've ever read? No. So, I mean, it doesn't have to be great writing for you to still enjoy a book.
I think it's about the story, and I think it's a more enjoyable story if the prose is better, but ultimately it's about the story. I've had a lot of people tell me that their favorite book of mine is my first book, Line of Vision. And I can tell you that that is the least well-written of my, I guess, nine books.
Really?
Oh, I think so, because I was still learning how to do it. I became a much better writer as I've gone on. I think I'm a much better writer now.
In what way? I mean, what makes you better now than you were then?
Oh, I think I can be more efficient. I think I can affect you in less words. I can convey my point more effortlessly. I always think the best writing is writing that is so good it seems effortless. It's so natural that you forget you're reading something that somebody typed up on a computer, and you just fall into the story.
And also,
it's so smooth.
What goes along with that is the believability factor. Have you ever read a book that you just said, this is not believable at all? I mean,
sure.
We've all done that.
Yeah, of course.
And I absolutely hate that feeling. If I ever feel that way about a book, I feel like I should stop reading it. Because it once you lose that sense of believability about a book, I mean, that is one of the most crucial things about reading a fiction book. It's got to be believable. It can't seem forced.
It's got to be believable on some level. And so that's the big challenge, because you also want to write fun stuff. And so you have to know where to draw those lines. I mean, somebody saving the world from a terrorist attack who's just an everyday Joe, is that the most likely thing in the world to happen? No. But if you can set up a premise that seems relatively believable, you know, there's always a little bit of suspension of disbelief. It just depends it's all in how you do it. It's all in what you're asking people to suspend. And so you have to think that through while you're plotting the book. Is this something that is so off the charts that no one will buy it?
I'm wondering if I'm even going to... I thought I had the wrong man figured out, but now I'm not so sure. Now you've got me thinking that I don't really know what's going to happen at the end of this book. Now I can't wait to go back and read and see if I'm right or if I'm wrong.
Yeah, you may... I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. And I won't tell you, of course.
Is your wife able to figure your books out? Does she know how they're going to end before they end?
Well, she suffers from being the only person in the world who I talk to about my books while I'm writing them. So she usually knows the ending.
I mean, you wouldn't even talk to me about it?
I would be happy to, off the record. I don't want to tell the readers, but no. I mean, she's usually the one who hears me talk about those middle 400 pages. Like, what do I do now? She's great because she reads so little in this genre, but she always gives me an idea in every book she has. In The Hidden Man, the first book in the series, she actually gave me the plot twist. Just talking one night, she said, "Well, what about this?" And she said, "This
that's great.
This may be a little much."
So she sounds like she's a little like Tori. Tori, who's coming up with these great ideas during the course of the wrong man.
Yeah. Tori does have good ideas.
Is she based on your wife a little bit?
Oh no. That woman is nothing like my wife.
Is your wife blonde and beautiful?
My wife is beautiful and brunette.
A brunette. Okay. I'm thinking about that as you're saying that she gives you these ideas, and how cool must that be?
Well, it's great. I mean, she's so supportive, and she puts up with all of the stuff that goes along with having to live with a writer, because we're all a little bit neurotic, and, you know, sometimes my head will be in the clouds because I'll be sitting there thinking about my book, and she'll be saying, "You're thinking about your book right now, aren't you?" You know, and she'll be trying to have a conversation with me.
She knows you too well.
Yeah, she's got me pegged.
You're
she's sticking with me.
And that's great. You know, that's fascinating to hear that. It's not often you hear that the writer's wife will help them out with a book.
Well, we don't talk very often about it, but if I've got something really bothering me, I'll lay it out for her. And she has this amazing ability, just when I'm talking very vaguely about things, to basically get where I'm going. And she'll say, "Well, don't do that. Everybody does that." Or, "Don't do that. That'll be too harsh. But how about this?" She's amazing. Every book, every time I have a conversation with her, I'm glad that I did.
But something tells me that it was still your idea of chapter 61.
61 was all me. For
was
better
all
or worse,
you.
It was all me.
That's really brilliant. It really is a brilliant chapter. I mean, I can't say that highly enough. It really is that great.
There was the fear that people would be like, "Oh, come on." I mean, you know, this feels out of place or something. You know, it's definitely an upheaval. It's certainly a table turner.
It certainly is. it's not only a table turner. You're going to laugh when you read it too, because when you realize how you've been taken in the first part of the chapter. And everybody out there, wait, just read it and enjoy. I can't wait to get people's reactions from it.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say it. Nice to hear that. It's really
It is nice. Now this is book number 3 in the series, right?
Yes.
Now, do you have a plot? Do you have a plan as far as how many books it's going to be? Could it be 45 books?
Oh, sure, it could. I'm gonna run Jason into the ground as much as I possibly can.
Could you be 91 and still write one of these books?
I would love to write Jason Coleridge when I'm 91.
I'd love
He's a fun guy. He's got so many places he can go that I think the sky's the limit for him. I've got some ideas of things that he might do and get caught up in, and they all...
But there's still things we don't know about him?
I don't know. You know, that's a really good question, and I ask myself that. I now chastise myself for saying so much about his background in the first book, because then, of course, I've tied myself down.
Right.
And I can't now have his mom being an undercover CIA agent or something, you know, who was injected with some drug that gave him superhuman powers, because she wasn't a CIA agent. So, you know, I don't know. That's a really interesting question, because I ask myself that same question, believe it or not. I literally ask myself that same question. Do I know everything about Jason? Is there something that I don't know about him yet? And I don't know the answer.
You know what other character I really would like, and I don't know whether we've seen him in the first few books, is that judge.
Yeah.
That judge is, was he in the first two books?
No, uh-uh.
So will he be back? Please tell me yes, because
I don't see why not. He's a very colorful guy. I really enjoyed writing.
Very, very colorful and very no nonsense. And you know, he's out to get Jason at some point. You know, and he's just not. I mean, just because he thinks Jason's not doing his job the way he should be doing.
But. Yeah, and he's getting on his bad side. He's pushing him a little bit, and some judges don't like to be pushed. I mean,
I think
judge's bad side.
Well, so you can promise me the judge will be back.
Yes, I will find more time for that judge.
Because I think that's too good of a character to let go of. It's kind of, he's kind of like a male Judge Judy.
Yeah, a little bit. He's one of these guys, and there are judges. I've been in front of these judges. You know, the courtroom is their kingdom, and nobody dare cross the man. And you know, then there are women judges aplenty. I've been in front of more women than men, but they don't tend to be like that as much. They don't tend to be as imperial. Some of them are, but the men especially, some of the men, who've been there for a long time, they start to believe their own.
Now, to be honest, do any of the judges ever, the real judges now, ever come up to you and say, was that me in one of your books?
I've never had that, but I've had judges come up to me. I've had many judges come up to me and talk to me about my books. And in one of the books, the second book I wrote, I had a character who reminds a lot of people of one of the venerable Chicago lawyers, a guy who's in his 80s now, who's been around since time immemorial, and he's, everybody knows him. And I had several people come up to me and say, you killed him, because that character meets an untimely death in the book. And they literally, this lawyer, because he's a friend of mine, he would get calls saying, Dave Ellis just killed you in a book.
Oh, really?
So he knew that. We had great fun with it. He reminds me of every time I see him.
Well, you know what you need to do with the next book? You need to come up with another chapter 61. That's what I say.
Well, you know what? It's a really tricky thing to do humor in a book, and I...
But you're good at it, but we know you're good at it, so I think you could do it again.
Well, I try, you know. Like, there's different kinds of humor. In fact, I've written about this in blogs, and I've said, you know, there's a kind of humor that works in a book, in a thriller, where you're really a ticking clock thriller, where you're racing against time to do something. To have something funny happen is really hard. I mean, there are books that are more cozy-type books, where you can have a whole, like, quirky character. You know, Janet Ivanovich, you know, she writes these thrillers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she's got a very quirky female lead who has all these male issues with men and all this stuff, and her mother, I think. And so that's fun. And that's one kind of a book. That's not what I write. I write more of the thriller type. Well, if you're going to do that, there's the wisecracking sort of humor, which does work in a thriller. You know, the sort of, you know, Harrison Ford making wisecracks as he's taking the Millennium Falcon through the asteroid field in Star Wars. I mean, that works.
Mm-hmm.
But to have laugh-out-loud, goofy, funny, which is what Chapter 61 was to some extent, to a large extent, that's really hard to put into a book that's otherwise a thriller.
But you didn't expect me to ask so much about Chapter 61.
Well, I'm glad you did, because it's something that moved you. I mean, it moved you in a way to laugh out loud about it. Which
I mean, I'm reading it this morning, and I'm thinking, am I reading this book right? Is this chapter of the book? The more I'm reading it, I mean, just getting such a kick out of it.
Yeah, well, I'll be interested to see how readers react to it. That probably won't be the last time I hear it. And there may be people who don't like it.
No, I don't think so. I think everybody's going to... You have to appreciate it for what it is. And once you read it, you'll know exactly what I mean. But I don't see anybody not appreciating that humor. I mean, I guess you get criticized. I mean, I guess you get emails saying people didn't like this.
Get it all the time.
Has there ever been anything in the book that you got thousands of emails about and people saying they didn't like it, and why did you put that in the book? Has there ever been anything like that?
There was a scene in the first Jason book, The Hidden Man, that I got hundreds of emails about. And it was because Jason in the first book was projecting his life going forward. And I can't get into too much more detail. If you don't know the personal tragedy, you won't understand. But he was projecting a daughter that never really happened. He didn't have this daughter. This daughter never happened. But he gave her a name in this projection he was doing. I think people read it as a flashback, but he wasn't flashing back. He was imagining what his life would have been had he not had this tragedy. And so he invented in his mind just two paragraphs, David, two paragraphs in the book, maybe even one paragraph, where he's having this little, it's italicized, it's clearly just a projection or whatever it is. It's clearly not happening in real time, of this daughter named Justine. Okay, didn't exist, but hundreds of people wrote to me and said, where did Justine go? She never appeared again in the book. What happened? Did she die? Did he give her up for adoption? Is he just not telling us about her? What happened? And I had to write back. I ended up having a stock email that I had to keep cutting and pasting saying, sorry for the confusion. She never existed at all. So and I felt bad about that, because that must have unsettled readers. And some people said, I liked your book, but I hated this because it didn't make sense, blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
So I actually took it out of the paperback. I wrote to my publisher, I said, take it out. It doesn't belong. It's not worth the confusion. Other people said, no, I understood what you were doing. But enough people didn't that it was not worth the unsettling. So it wasn't so much, it was more just, I love your book, but please explain this to me.
That's really interesting.
And that was a failure on my part.
I have to ask you one more thing before we... Boy, it's been so enjoyable. I don't even want this to end.
This has been great, David.
I have to ask you about post-traumatic distress disorder. We really didn't talk much about that, and that's very central to the guy who's been accused of murder here. But did you meet with guys who had been through that? It fascinates me. I mean, I think of that movie with Don Johnson. What was it? Ceasefire, I think it was called, where he goes around with his gun and almost shoots his child. Did you meet people who've been through this?
No, I didn't meet anybody. I met with some veterans. I talked to some psychiatrists, and I researched it a lot.
Well, how prevalent it? I mean, how prevalent is it? Is it a problem that's getting worse?
I think that it is probably, like a lot of diseases, mental diseases, it comes in varying degrees. There are probably a lot of people who will be forever undiagnosed with PTSD, but who suffer it to some extent. There are the stories you hear about where people literally lose their mind. They start shooting it at an imaginary enemy who's really just somebody walking down the street. There's those extreme cases. Then there's a lot of other people who will probably never diagnose. There's probably scores of veterans of all of the wars who came back damaged in ways that they never talk about, or they never openly expressed, they never got treated for, and it changed their lives.
Why is it? It always makes me wonder, and I always ask this question to people, why men have so much trouble opening up? I mean, there are so many men out there who do have trouble, And there's of course, there's exceptions, but why in general do men have trouble opening up?
Well, in this context in particular, I think you've got men who are probably, especially in a volunteer draft, the kind of men who go into war, who join the army, are going to be pretty tough guys to begin with. I mean, sometimes they go there because it's their only option, right? Because they have no money for education or something. But a lot of people are just these pretty tough, intense people. And those people are the least likely to say, let me tell you about my feelings now. Let me tell you how I'm feeling about things. The real sensitive guys are probably not the ones saying, sign me up. I want to shoot a gun.
Right.
So that's a bad combo. These people are already probably not the most open people in the world. And then they go and they're put into situations where they have to do horrible things, probably some things they're not proud of, and then other things where they did it exactly the way they were supposed to, but it still resulted in killing people. I mean, I cannot even imagine what it would be like to be in battle. I mean, thank God I'm not, but, in a different era, I would have, you and I could have been, over in Normandy Beach or something, and doing things that turn
out. I wonder if they're taught not to show emotion at all in boot camp. I mean, what does boot camp tell you about showing emotion?
Yeah, I mean, everything I've seen and heard about boot camp, it's certainly not about being warm and fuzzy. It's about being tough and hard. So these people are taught to be tough and hard, then they go do horrible things and they come back, and it's not in their DNA.
Well, I wonder how many are actually able to talk to psychiatrists and work things out and get better as a result of that. I wonder how many can do that.
Probably not enough.
I mean,
it's a real tragedy. That's why I enjoyed writing about it, because I thought it's something that we should never stop talking about, the damage that occurs to our veterans when they come home, when they're over there, and how they cope with it when they come home.
Absolutely.
I mean, you can't give these people enough. You can't give them enough health care. You can't give them enough mental health care, psychological services, job placements. I mean, there's nothing worse than seeing a veteran who's homeless. I mean, that's just total tragedy. These people put their lives on their line for us. Whether you like the war or not is irrelevant. They did their duty, and then they come back, and there's nothing for them here. It's just a tragedy.
Now, have you picked the title for the next book?
No, the titles usually come last. I usually write the book and then think...
Can you give us a little hint about what it might be about? Or would you rather not?
What I have in mind, because I'm not entirely sure, but I better get sure pretty quickly, because I got to get my book done in a few months here, is so don't tell my publisher I'm not sure yet. But he witnesses a suicide, and he tries to prevent it, and he's unsuccessful, and he now wants to know why that happened. He's given some idea during the suicide that there's some bad things going on, and Jason's a guy who doesn't like injustice. It makes him mad. It upsets his equilibrium when something's not, somebody's been treated badly, and so he wants to fix it, and he finds himself in the middle of something really bad.
Now, do you say to your wife, do you tell the premise of the book and say, now, what do you think, dear? Is that a really good idea for a book, or does that really suck?
Yeah, no, I will tell my wife that. I will almost always tell her, this is what I want to do next, and then she'll tell me what she thinks of it.
That's great.
That might be to this or that, or that sounds really cool, and she's brutally honest, because it does me no favors for her to just be polite to me.
Right. Absolutely. Boy, it's been so much fun talking. I hate to even end the interview. I've had so much fun. You're so enjoyable to talk to.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, this has been a great talk. And, let's do it more often, Dave.
Yeah, absolutely. The new book, again, is called The Wrong Man. It's number 3, Jason Kolarich. And
right.
What, I'm sorry?
Yeah, that's exactly
okay,
right.
Okay,
yeah.
I thought I said it wrong. And it's in all your bookstores. It will be on the 14th of June. You probably will hear this on around that date anyway. But
yeah.
By Putnam. And it's available as an e-book and everything, I'm sure.
Sure is.
It's been great, David. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks, David. I appreciate it.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.